So good afternoon, everyone. Welcome. I hope you have entered the right room because you have entered the carbon conundrum. Woo. And I expect that you are prepared to engage us in transformational thinking on our climate and carbon crisis today. And so we're very fortunate to have convened a great panel of dynamic actors and strategists who wake up every day to find the solutions that work to ensure our transition to cleaner energy and aggressive carbon reduction while facing the challenges of balancing the economy and the environment. And of course, there are always unintended consequences, some winners and some losers, and the challenge of equity and distributional justice. So we're going to talk about all of that today, beginning with an RPA overview assessment of our challenge by Steve Caputo, who's the research fellow at RPA. He recently joined RPA to help shape the energy and climate recommendations for the fourth regional plan. He has served in the de Blasio administration as senior advisor to the deputy mayor for housing and economic development, and served in the Bloomberg administration as deputy director of the Office of Long-Term Planning and Sustainability. In addition, Steve is a lecturer at the Columbia University Earth Institute and School of Professional Studies. So we'll hear in a few minutes from Steve. Judith Lugano is senior vice president of asset management at NRG Energy Commission, and I'm sorry, I've just got confused here.
I can introduce the company. So NRG is the largest independent power producer in the U.S. with over 50,000 megawatts of diverse resources and powered by solar, wind, nuclear, natural gas, coal, oil, and cogeneration of many types. We're one of the nation's largest retail energy providers with over 3 million customers and one of the largest owners and operators of renewable energy. Will that do?
That will do quite nicely, thank you. We also have Gene Fox. And Gene, what is going on here? Gene began her 35-year state and national career at the New Jersey Board of Public Utilities as a lawyer and rose to become chief of staff. She later returned as the board's president and member of the governor's cabinet. She has served as commissioner of the New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection and the regional administrator for Region 2 during the Clinton administration, which is where I met you. She is currently an adjunct professor at Columbia School of International and Public Affairs and will be teaching at Princeton's Woodrow Wilson School in the fall. And last but not least is Arturo Garcia Costas. And Arturo is the Environmental Program Officer at the New York Community Trust, and he runs the local New York City program as well as the national program that significantly focuses on climate and energy. While at the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation, he co-authored the environmental justice analysis in the state energy plan. And, of course, that requires, for the first time, an environmental justice analysis. So we are going to now hear opening remarks from Steve Caputo.
Thank you, Peggy, and thanks everyone who's on the panel today, including Arturo, who made a last-minute effort to be here. I'm going to step down here. Can I still be mics? Everybody can hear me still? Okay, great. So first slide. Oh, where's the first slide? Yeah. I know, so today we're going to talk about the carbon conundrum, and it's a conundrum because it's a global problem, it's a local problem, and there's no easy solutions, and it's something that's going to really impact our region. So we're going to talk through first the problems and the sort of complexity and nuances of some of the problems, and then shift to what some of the solutions could be that RPA is putting on the table for discussion, and then hopefully have a pretty good debate and discussion with the panelists and you guys in the audience. So I know you guys are all tired of seeing images of Hurricane Sandy. We all remember what it was like. It was really intense, especially if you lived in one of the flood-prone areas. So I spared you a picture of Hurricane Sandy, and I'm showing you a picture of February of 2016. This is Broad Channel. There was a winter storm system that, combined with a high tide, led to several feet, looks like 3 feet of flooding. This was about 24, 48 hours later after these events. So climate change is here and it's now, and it's not something that we can look 20 years out and start to worry about. We have to worry about it now. And just to give you a little perspective on RPA's engagement with climate change, the organization has done a lot of work recently, but if you think back 20 years to the third regional plan, there was a paragraph on climate change. Carbon dioxide was mentioned. And just to put some numbers on that, at that point, the year prior was the fifth warmest year on record since 1880. So that was a big deal then. There weren't a lot of solutions in the plan, but it at least kind of acknowledged it. So now come forward 20 years. 15 of the 16 last years were the warmest on record. Last year was the warmest on record. And now we're talking really about, these got out of order somehow, really transformational change over the lifetime of this new plan. So this is an image of just kind of close-up of two parts of the region, obviously Lower Manhattan, and we have the Meadowlands on the left. And this is what the 100-year floodplain is going to look like in 2050. So pretty sobering that you have like so much infrastructure and now mixed-use development and transit coming through the Meadowlands, and it's all exposed to flooding. And Lower Manhattan, obviously, much more exposed to storm surge. Sorry, this is the last one that will be out of order. Okay, hopefully. And just to put some numbers to that, so today there's about 1 million people in the floodplain, and about, according to RPA's estimates, about 35% of them should be considered as vulnerable in terms of their economic ability, their mobility, and just their income levels and ability to adapt quickly to these issues. By 2050, we're talking about another 1 million people that are exposed. When we talk about sea level rise, these maps are about 3 feet of sea level rise, and that's about 170,000 people whose homes would be permanently inundated by sea level rise. And if you talk up closer to 6 feet, you're talking about almost 750,000 people who are impacted. So this is major stuff. This is like at the core of what this regional plan needs to talk about. And I think what makes it even more challenging is it's, you know, huge potential local and regional impacts, but this is a global problem. New York region can't solve this one on its own. You've got massive deforestation occurring. You have basically all of our industry, the industry and the both heavy and light industry throughout the world that helps fuel our economy, puts our cell phones in our pockets, all that stuff. That's all of our problem collectively, and obviously traffic and cars and mobility is a big one. So global problem. We started to see global commitments, which is incredibly exciting. In Paris in the fall, and then recently, last week actually, this agreement was signed. And it was a commitment to try to keep temperatures within the range where we wouldn't have catastrophic climate impacts, and to reduce our emissions 80% by mid-century. So that's terrific. President Obama has really led on this issue, both in the regulatory context, through CAFE standards, through innovation and funding. But the challenge is, and partly why he's sweating there, it's not really enough. The Clean Power Plan, I think, is a signature initiative. Are folks familiar with the Clean Power Plan? How many folks in the room are energy people or not energy people? Okay, good. And good to have a balance in the room. So the Clean Power Plan is a plan to reduce emissions in the country by 32% by 2030. It's, given the political context that we face in the United States, it's an ambitious plan. But on the other hand, it's not that ambitious for our region. So this is a simple chart that shows the level of emissions in the region. Actually, this is actually just for New York State, but it's meant to illustrate a point, which is that a couple points. Well, first, you can see Reggie Sorry, let me just back up for a second. This is a graph showing what the region has done for climate change, and what we've done is created a market-based mechanism. It's called the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, and it's a consortium of 9 states who've gotten together and said, we've got to do something. It's had its ups and downs, but it's been effective at creating a marketplace for trading allowances for polluting carbon, and we've seen some good reduction. So what I'm going to talk about here is how that program relates to this national agenda that we now have. So in a nutshell, these are New York State's emissions. So originally 65 million tons of emissions back in 2010, and this is 2015, and this is projected forward based on this regional program. So as you can see, we've already had very significant reductions in emissions. Now that's great news, obviously. What we should know about this, there's a little bit of wind and solar and energy efficiency in there, but most of this is natural gas. The cheapness of natural gas, its abundance over the past 5 to 8 years has really driven out coal, driven out heavy heating oil from the power sector, and pushed it towards natural gas. So that, from a carbon standpoint, is more beneficial, and we've seen a big reduction. But that's pretty much done. There's not much more to get out of the system. We're pretty much there already. But Reggie's going to keep taking us. The commitments are out to 2020, so it's going to keep taking us there. But the other thing I want you to focus on in this graph is this is what the Clean Power Plan is meant to do. So you can see, basically, Reggie, the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, for New York State at least, is less stringent than our existing system, and New York State is almost practically there right now. This isn't true across all of the states, but it's a common issue. So not only is the federal policy not going to do much in the region from carbon reduction standpoint, our local or regional system also won't do that much to meet our longer-term goals. So the goal that we've collectively agreed to in Paris and in New York State and Connecticut, not New Jersey, is to reduce our emissions 40% by 2030. So within the time frame of this plan, we're trying to cut 40% of our emissions. So Reggie is only going to get basically halfway there. There's that big blue slice there that we're not certain how to get there. And there's a lot of different ideas about how we should get there, and we'll talk about them today. There's different opinions about whether this greenhouse gas trading, cap and trade system should do it. Should it be a carbon tax? Should it be large-scale renewable energy paid for by government? We're going to get into that today. One thing I want to focus on, though, is no matter how we get to that deep reduction in carbon, we're going to have to pay for it. And it's going to be expensive, and part of the goal is to minimize its cost. But there's also likely to be equity impacts. And this slide, you don't have to understand the details of this slide, but this is a report, this is a study that just came out that says, let's assume we have a carbon tax, which is putting a price on carbon and saying, let's tax it so we can get it out of the economy. But it could be market system, it could be pretty much anything. And it says, let's assume that that's revenue neutral, and the money will go back to address, basically, go back to people who can afford to pay more for their energy the least, so the poorest people in the country. And this is 3 different schemes that are basically refunding the money, and you don't really need to know the details of them. One of them is just a bulk refund, and then 2 or other through tax policy. But what you can see here is all the different colors mean the amount of how well off each group is. So the redder you are on that chart, the worse off you are, and the bluer you are, the better off. And there's 5 categories here, so going from the sort of lowest earners in the country to the highest earners. All you really need to understand this is the range of colors. These are 3 different policies that are meant to address equity issues, and they all do it in really different ways and have very different outcomes. In some cases, everyone's a little worse off. In some cases, the wrong people are better off from an economic standpoint. So this is a really important thing to keep in mind. The good news is we have a transformational energy infrastructure vision in mind through solar and storage and renewable energy and electric vehicles. The problem is we have a really fragmented energy system. Not to go into details on this, but there's a lot of different players who regulate the energy system. We have 3 different zones of operating the bulk level transmission energy system. We have 5 regulators. We have 10 electric utilities, and we have dozens of generators. So this system doesn't naturally want to work together. And this map is one of the biggest keys. There's three different operators of our grid at a big scale for within this region. That's not easy to overcome. We also have a lot of competing priorities and conflicting programs. This is just stuff that's happening in New York State. A lot of it's great, but it's not all coordinated. This is something that Judith and maybe others will talk about, but it's not a great environment for investing in energy. You may have heard that oil was down to $30 a barrel. These charts show that over the next 10 years, the best guess of the energy industry is that our growth of energy is going to be flat. So this is basically today, and this is 2025. This is kind of what's happening with our energy growth. It's not really going anywhere. But on the other hand, the hottest days of the year, that's going to grow. So that's what this line is. And one of the big problems is the more this is flat and the more this grows, the less efficient your system is, and how do you overcome something like that? One caveat to this is we always have to worry about growing. I mean, we have to think we're going to grow. This is a regional plan. We're going to grow. And Tom Wright today said we might need 25% more energy someday. So we can't let complacency set in, even though for the next 10 years it looks like we're not going to be using more energy. This is the potential unintended consequence. This is an image of what the city might look like with no lights in the region. It's quite beautiful, but probably none of us ever want to see it, at least when it's like this.
So. We've already seen it.
Yeah, this is like real, though. This is like there's no lights anywhere. So in any case, so we'll hear some more about the importance of reliability on this panel. So now that's kind of the carbon conundrum, right? There's a lot of complicated issues, but we didn't want to just talk about the problems. We wanted to put some issues on the table. You'll see in the next slides, these are our high-level principles. First, we've got to go with institutions that are already working. We have to plan collaboratively across these regulated lines and artificial boundaries. We have to create a level playing field so that New Jersey, New York, Connecticut are playing by the same rules, have the same types of markets to encourage investment. Obviously, minimize the cost, minimize the equity impacts, don't lose sight of reliability, and then we got to go big. So starting with going big, this is a letter to the next president. We're trying to lighten it up here. So this is a letter to the next president, which says, "Dear President Brackett," you can all help decide who that is.
New York.
We're not going to talk about politics here.
It's got to be a New Yorker.
That's true.
It will be a New Yorker.
That's true. That's scary and true. So dear President so-and-so, please follow through on our nation's commitment to meet these aggressive goals in reducing climate change and reducing our emissions to help save our region. And so what this is calling for really is create a binding federal action plan. Like, the regulations, the incrementalist approach is great. And today someone said something really smart on the panel about we've exhausted incrementalism, in other words. So we need a real action plan for the federal government. So that's what that's meant to evoke. The next thing is, in the absence of that kind of program, we already have our regional greenhouse gas initiative, which is all these states, minus a couple here. And there's also an equally successful one that's really started in California and some of the western states and now has come all the way across Canada. So the idea here is, well, let's get them together. Let's have a trading environment that's much bigger. Let's have some uniformity in the rules. There's going to be disagreement about this idea, and in particular how aggressive the carbon cap for this whole system should be. But New York in this region has always led, so we really think that revamping these carbon trading systems are about the best thing we can do at this point. And also figuring out how we can bring in things like energy efficiency, transportation, and greater use of offsets. Like, it doesn't matter necessarily if we plant a tree that's going to reduce carbon somewhere else versus, reducing an electron here, and that might help keep the cost down. Then we want to facilitate large-scale investment, and one of the biggest things we can do is, again, creating a level playing field, and we'll hear some of that today. One of the big issues with developing new resources is price certainty. It's hard to finance new big projects if you don't know if the market's going to crash or the policy's going to change or you don't have a long-term contract. Just a couple other ideas on that. The region needs to figure out the bulk energy system, how we flow power across the entire area, and that's we're calling for a regional transmission plan. And then we have great offshore wind resources. The whole region has to get together to focus on that rather than this piecemeal effort. Couple more recommendations. This one's really focused on what does the footprint of the energy system look like? So this is a sort of pretend postcard showing a power plant in Astoria. Any of you who know Astoria might know that there's a massive complex of power plants and other energy infrastructure in the northern part. So that's it's a challenge. It's kind of, and it's also a remnant of the way our local energy infrastructure works. In a nutshell, we are required. New York City is an area that doesn't have enough energy to serve its load. So we're required to be able to never have less than about 80% of our energy capacity in the city. What that's led to is giant, really old plants that are just sticking around, basically, and some of them only fire up 7 days a year when it's really hot. So why should RPA care about that? Because look at the size of this piece of property. I'm not saying this is the only one I could find a postcard for, but we have some big sites in the city that either they should be modernized or they should be transformed, and we're thinking about how to transform those sites. So how to do that? First, we need to get those hot days under control. We need to not have the system go so out of control, and we can do that through energy efficiency, storage, and other things. We need to get more transmission infrastructure into the city, and we need to kind of create that grid vision that we saw before, which hopefully allows for opportunities to redevelop these sites, both in the city and maybe outside, and then redesign our postcards. And then this is the last point is, I think we're finding more and more, and some of the folks on the panel today have been involved in some of these projects, when you engage communities, when you look locally on the energy problem, you get some interesting results, whether it's through aggregating purchasing power or access to renewable energy, or it's looking at resiliency issues and related to energy. There's a lot we can do on that front. So, sorry, one last letter to the future. This one is basically, the premise here is, okay, flat energy now, lots of solar, lots of wind, we're going to do everything we can. But the truth is there's probably an energy transformation that needs to come because the whole world is globalizing, right? So, so this letter is to a future Nobel Prize winner or billionaire. Let's face it, we're going to need a lot of energy, and we need a major transformation. And if any place can make it happen, it's this region. So get busy, stop sleeping. And this letter, unlike the last letter that was from 20 million regional residents, this is from 7.4 billion people. So that's the go big part. So thank you.
So thank you, Steve. I'm going to begin with a question to each of our panelists. They'll have a 2-minute response so that we can begin to engage all of us in the conversation. So I'm going to begin with Judith Lugano. Steve and RPA have just issued the challenge that we need a transformational energy breakthrough. And so you're at NRG, the largest independent power producer in the U.S., with diverse resources powered by solar, wind, nuclear, gas, coal, oil, cogeneration.
Yes.
And you're one of the nation's largest competitive retail energy suppliers. So what is NRG's transformational energy vision?
Well, that's one of our favorite things to talk about at NRG, so I came to the right place. And I also don't sleep, so I have that part covered.
I'm
ready to go. So as the largest power producer in the U.S., our future is really dependent on our ability to address climate change and to assure a sustainable future, a sustainable business future for our company and our industry and throughout. So in order to advance the goals that have been set regionally, nationally, now internationally, we ourselves have set goals to reduce our own carbon footprint in the U.S., by 50% by 2030 and 90% by 2050. So in order for us to do that, we're going to have to employ a number of technologies in order to do that. And I think we're well positioned to do that. We need to be able to enable greater customer empowerment, because after all, energy consumers are our customers. And we have to do it in a, we need an efficient and resilient grid that provides, again, customer access to comprehensive choices that ensure distributed resources are given the platform to be deployed and access to all customers. So we know that in our industry, there are two trends that are really affecting the energy industry today, which you spoke a little bit about, the sustained low cost of natural gas and also declining cost of clean technologies. So in our area, natural gas prices are about a quarter of what they were 10 years ago. And this has created this abundance of gas coupled with the environmental regulations on mercury and air toxics have driven substantial shift in the energy mix crossing a large part of the U.S. and significantly decreasing carbon emissions. And the cost of renewable energy, both solar and wind, coupled with strong incentives in the states, has caused the advancement and the development and deployment of clean resources. That this has had a positive impact on the region's greenhouse gas emissions. So we expect that these trends will continue to be the dominant factors in decarbonizing the power grid over the short term. However, to make we need to have a meaningful dialogue on the best policy levers in order to decarbonize further so that we can meet the goals that have been set by COP21 and other regional initiatives. So I want to reflect on it for a moment on the magnitude of the greenhouse gas emission reduction or greenhouse gas reductions that are going to be required to meet U.S. climate goals announced in Paris this last December. By 2050, the entire U.S. economy will need to reduce annual greenhouse gas emissions below today's power sector greenhouse gas emissions. That is a monumental task, right? So to achieve that decarbonization from the power sector, it will take more than just a switch from coal to gas. It will take other initiatives, right? So to reach deep decarbonization, we will need to substantially expand the use of renewables, augmented by other technologies such as storage, demand management, and advanced highly flexible gas units for balancing over the next 30 years. And we believe the most cost-effective means of implementing large-scale renewables is through long-term bundled power agreements that include both energy and RECs that are financeable and manageable from the standpoint of the folks that have to be making these investments, and they need the confidence that when they do invest, that they have the security and they have the revenues that they expect to earn over the life of that investment. So I think that there are numerous tools at our disposal, and although decarbonization to this degree is an immense challenge, it's an immense opportunity. So policy is going to play a very decisive role in marshaling the capital into energy infrastructure that will remain useful and environmentally sound for decades to come. And we as a company look forward to contributing to that very important discussion about policy towards building our 2050 low carbon future.
Okay, thank you. And Jean Fox. Steve mentioned the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, REGGI. And we know that's the first market-based regulatory program in the U.S. to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And we realize that the cap represents a regional budget for CO2 emissions from the power sector, but will REGGI get us the reductions that we have targeted?
Oh, I think so, but the issue is bigger than that. I mean, REGGI was started to form, I was involved with the negotiations and on the first board back in 2005. And the purpose, in my mind, I think most of the, and this was the first time ever that utility commissioners and environmental commissioners actually met together, and there were 10 states. So basically New England down to Delaware, Maryland, and New Jersey in between, no, not Pennsylvania, it was a coal state, it still is a coal state, but got together and went through this, and we did it because we wanted to have a model that worked so that Congress would know something would work. And there were Democratic and Republican governors, Pataki, who does know that climate change was going on, and he knew it back then, and George Romney, who was the Massachusetts Republican governor, and both of them actually kicked off Reggie. And so the goal was to really to reduce carbon emissions in the energy sector. And that's what we ended up with. However, the choice back then was cap and trade or a carbon tax. Carbon tax is more democratic. Cap and trade is a market-based, it's Republican. So because Pataki and Romney were very supportive of this, and actually their staffs were the lead on it, the Reggie negotiators and the governors who signed the MOA in December 05 picked the cap and trade program, because at that point in time, there were most members of Congress who were Republicans, like John McCain and others, were supportive, knew that climate change was happening, and were in fact supportive of taking action, but they wanted a cap and trade, a market-based approach, not a tax. That's why Reggie was set up that way, for the politics of getting something through Washington. Now, the system is definitely, and I don't need to go into detail about the system, the system has definitely worked, but it was only for the electric generating companies in those states, and it only applied to CO2, carbon emissions, no other greenhouse gas. And they've gone on since then and have, in fact, lowered it, and they're doing, actually, right now they're doing the 2016 review. And so the Great Recession of late 08 and what happened lowered emissions. So what we negotiated back then obviously got reductions, emissions were reduced just because of that. So Reggie is a good thing, but it doesn't get us to where we wanted to go to, which was having a national cap and trade program, which almost got through, I don't know, about 5-6 years ago, but wasn't. And so that's a huge issue. I note that my state was in it. My governor, Chris Christie, took us out of it. At the same time, he announced that he was leaving Reggie because it wasn't economical for the state. He did, in fact, say that climate, he was taught by the Princeton and Rutgers scientists involved with the IPCC that, in fact, climate change was happening and man had something to do with it, but that was within the purview of going out of Reggie because Reggie wasn't effective. A lot of the, at least a minimum of 25% of the money that came into the states, came in for sale of the allowances, had to go to citizens either, and state by state, the state decided, because all the states are different. Could be for clean technology, go as a direct rebate to ratepayers, to customers who are paying for this. Could go for energy efficiency programs. A lot were used for low-income people. And different types of renewables, the states decided themselves. It ended up, I fought hard and threatened to walk to get something in their requirement. It ended up that most of the states gave most of the money to those good purposes to further reduce carbon emissions. But Reggie and then California, the Western States Coalition, I note that that was started with California and a couple other states out there, Arizona, New Mexico being two of them, Napolitano and Richardson went to Washington, Republican governors replaced them, they pulled out of that. So now California is working with 5 Canadian provinces. And they're doing a trading system, but California actually is going farther than Reggie. We were way before California, but they're going past carbon, just carbon, from emissions from generating stations. So there's a lot to do. Regionally, though, it makes sense. I fully expect, the new Pennsylvania governor has campaigned on, when he gets sworn in January, joining Reggie, which has always been an issue. And I have no doubt in my mind that when New Jersey gets the next governor, that New Jersey will want to come back in. But we still have a lot of other states to take care of.
Thank you. Next question is to Arturo Garcia-Costas. And the question is, as we work to find solutions to a cleaner grid, what are the challenges we face regarding equity, distributed energy resources, and energy insecurity?
First of all, let me just say, since I only stepped into this panel 20 minutes ago, I didn't have time to prepare remarks, so... like the bard said, I'm going to speak extemporaneously from the mother wit.
That's good.
Yes, Arturo is replacing Rory Christian, who from EDF, who had a family emergency.
His wife is having a family blessing. Yes. His wife is having a baby.
That's the only excuse that we would take, but the baby is coming and is here, but he's with the baby and his wife.
Yeah, that's right. There's applause. So to answer that question, I will say that one of the elements of the environmental justice movement across the United States and in New York specifically has focused on the issues of energy, on a concentration of power generating facilities and the impacts on low-income communities near them. And there's also been problems over the years with these communities accessing energy efficiency investments. With the stimulus money, there was a huge influx of money focused on weatherization, for example. But that actually created this bump up, and then it dropped back down again. But over the years, it's just we don't have a situation where low-income communities across the United States have had the same access to clean energy as other communities for a variety of reasons. So for that reason, the state, which does an energy planning process every 3 years, it's the state energy plan, they passed a law that required an environmental justice analysis for the first time for the current energy plan that was just approved. And as part of that environmental justice analysis, we looked at a bunch of the issues that that Peggy just referenced. We looked at issues of burdens. We looked at issues of benefits. And one thing is very clear when you're talking about responding to climate change, climate mitigation, which you're going to look at things like potential carbon taxes, potential energy taxes. You got to be careful with those interventions because they're fundamentally regressive, or they could be regressive. They're going to potentially have a larger impact on low-income communities. And indeed, in downstate New York, the energy cost of living, which you don't hear a lot of. You hear a lot about cost of living, and you hear a lot about poverty. But in some parts of New York City, the energy cost of living is up to 10-12% of disposable income for some households. And in Westchester and in Long Island, it soars up to 18-19%. So this is a huge amount of money that these households have to put towards energy. So these policy initiatives, these policy interventions, such as a carbon tax or an energy tax, have to be adjusted or designed to mitigate those regressive impacts. Now, how that happens, I really liked what Steve put up in the chart. You've got examples like in British Columbia where they've had a carbon tax for a while, and it's a revenue neutral carbon tax. However, I have read analyses of the situation there, and once again, low-income communities are not necessarily benefiting equally, as his chart indicated, from that revenue neutrality. We have to examine whether or not we look at hybrid approaches where you have a carbon taxation that is somewhat revenue neutral but also includes rebates for lower-income households. So that's on the mitigation side. On the adaptation side, you've got, as we know from Sandy, you had power outages across New York City, and because of the legacy of Robert Moses, we had a lot of public housing in the floodplain and vulnerable areas, which was affected, and we had areas that were without power for weeks. So, Sandy was a major event, but the notion of power outages, that's something that's quite likely to happen much more often in the future with much greater frequency, because you could have issues of windstorms, ice storms. You could have intense precipitation of different types that can create power outages in one area. So looking at how resilience works in a more power outage-prone future, that's very much of a climate justice issue that has to be understood. And some of the approaches that they're looking at focus on things like microgrids. But microgrids, the notion of having an anchor institution that provides power to a neighborhood or to a region, that's attractive in a lot of ways, but it's unlikely to be able to be scaled up broadly across the city or the state. So we have to look very, very creatively at how we deal with those resilience issues. And And I think that there's one example right now with restructuring that's happening in New York State that's very instructive, and that's the Brooklyn-Queens demand management area. I don't know how many are familiar with the situation there, but basically Con Ed would have to build, in order to meet demand, would have to build, I think, $1 billion or more than $1 billion substation. Rather than doing that, they're saying, okay, well, instead of doing that, let's provide a great deal of money to pay for distributed generation, to pay for energy efficiency investments across that community. But the challenge that they're running up against is that that is high transaction costs. You know, that involves lots of individual discussions with household owners, with tenant associations, with businesses, what have you. And if you're going to take that path, which I think is probably the path to take, you have to build into the system enough money and resources to have intermediary organizations, intermediary institutions to help with that community planning process. And I will close with one of the things that I think is very interesting. The NYSERDA is about to do an RFP later this year that focuses on the issue of community level energy planning. Mm-hmm. All of the changes that are happening right now in the power sector in New York State, in order to maximize the benefits and in order to avoid these equity issues, you really need to have these communities start to understand what's going on and to plan to derive the greatest benefit. And that RFP is going to basically create models that then could perhaps be replicated through legislation or regulation across the state. So I'm sorry, that's like all over the place, but like, you know, it's a bit stream of consciousness.
So Arturo, I mean, I think what we really want at the end of the day is we want true, verifiable reductions in greenhouse gas emissions, but not at the expense of unnecessarily high energy pricing, right? I mean, that's really what we're trying to, I think, does anyone disagree with that, right? Right? So we want true reductions at an energy price that's affordable, right? So I think when we look at what are the appropriate caps to have, let's say, would a cap unnecessarily drive up carbon pricing to the point where it's not enough to actually incent investment in renewables, but it's raising the price of energy, right? So that unfortunately does. I mean, that challenges folks that are struggling today, and it doesn't meet the objectives that we all want to see, which is reductions in greenhouse gas
emissions. I think the biggest issue is planning. As was said, we really need something at the federal level. But local governments from little towns on up to counties and people all over big cities are doing these type of things, and they should continue to do that until the feds get their act together. But some kind of concerted plan. I've been in the utility regulation business for 23 and a half years. I'm very concerned about costs for low income, but for working class, because I'll tell you, we all know the working class and middle class are going down hard, and they can't afford their electricity bills. So for stranded costs. So you know utilities, if they're not in New York and New Jersey and most of New England except for one state, they used to own their electricity generation. Well, they don't. But some utilities, like PSE&G, which is the largest in New Jersey, supplies 70% of the electricity in the state. They also have the gas company as well. They were allowed to, I wasn't there then, it was before me, I wouldn't have done this. They were allowed to keep the generating station in an affiliate company. So there's supposed to be a firewall between the utility and the generating company. I don't think there is, really, because the generation, they want to sell the generation in our market. And utilities in general around the country, not all states are restructured like New York and New Jersey are. Utilities want construction. So even in the restructured markets like New York and New Jersey, transmission lines, I think we need them, but how many do we need? Because they go into their rate base, they get a rate of return, their shareholders in those investments. A lot of these structures that utilities and other energy providers do are based on the long-lived, the 40 years, the 50 years out. Well, if they're going to build something today, even if it's a natural gas plant, and natural gas is still a fossil fuel and it still puts out carbon emissions, and there's a lot more research being done on extracting of natural gas and the methane, which is 20 times worse today in the atmosphere for greenhouse gas than carbon is. It just doesn't live as long, but we'll be dead by then. Methane comes from natural gas. And that big explosion out in California, that's methane. which is much, much, much worse than carbon. And yet Reggie just deals with the carbon issue. Now, people didn't, when you burn natural gas, it does burn less carbon, probably a third to a half. But extraction of the natural gas is something that is just being looked at in the last couple of years, and some scientists, climate scientists, are really freaking out about the methane. So we really need something that distributed energy resources, which a lot of customers, and especially in this area, are demanding, whether it's a commercial, industrial, or a business. Some of them are trying to do microgrids. There's some federal projects. Hoboken has a microgrid, and there's some going on around the state. But most of those are based for where maybe senior citizens live, for the emergency responders, for the fire department, and someplace, maybe a college campus, where people who don't have electricity can go to, and the emergency responders or the people coming from other states to help us can stay at. We have to factor in that's the technologies, the new technologies. What New York is doing with REV, and they're friends of mine, so I keep on saying they're going to come out with something great, they better, is trying to put it all together. Nobody else is doing this anywhere. And trying to put it all together, and not just piecemeal. So a lot of utilities and a lot of people on the national level say, we need a lot more transmission lines, we need more natural gas lines. Well, yeah, but how long are we going to be using them? If we're using them for the next 30 to 50 years, we're in trouble. Because I think we're just about, like, we're over that hurdle. I mean, we were definitely having impacts. We see them every year about climate change. We had three major events, three 100-year events in 18 months in the Northeast. We had Sandy, we had the derecho, which is like from Chicago to Washington, 100 miles wide and 600 miles long, that just 100-mile-an-hour winds just took everything out. And there were the hottest summer ever at that point was in 2011. That was all within 18 months, and they were all 100-year events. It's happening more and more. So we really have to plan and not just let utilities or FERC, Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, approve new gas lines and new transmission lines, even if they're interstate, because they will be stranded costs. And a lot of those stranded costs will, in fact, be paid for by ratepayers of all varieties.
So, Jean, you know, we talk a lot about glide paths and not cliffs, right?
Exactly.
Because what a glide path will do is it will enable the development of new technologies which are coming down in costs every single day, right? So what we are trying to avoid is a lock-in of gas and a lock-out of renewables, right? So the transition is extremely important about how we do that because these investments, I know, I'm in the industry, they are very long-term investments, right? So there is no question that there will be some need for gas to back up, you know, heavy integration of renewables, right? But we have to do this in a manner where we don't foreclose investment in new renewable technologies, right? So I think we can do this if we do this smartly.
Well, can I ask, how do you view the storage revolution within the frame that you just articulated? And particularly, right now, we've been talking about REGI. REGI's undergoing its 2016 program review. So now is the time, really, if you've ever been thinking about REGI, to consider putting some suggestions to how REGI can be improved going forward.
Go to the website. It's all there.
It's all there. So, and one of the things that I've been thinking about is how to approach storage, break out of the silo thinking that happens just all the time in any bureaucracy and across human experience, so that when it comes to REGI going forward, when it comes to keeping it as a aggressive, forward-thinking, groundbreaking initiative as opposed to being left off the hook by the Clean Power Plan. When I think about it that way, the issue of storage and looking at and electric vehicles and looking at fleets and looking at putting storage facilities next to fleets to relieve diesel emissions and those sorts of impacts that are externalized from the costs are not really taken into consideration. And to look at all the other ways that storage can make a difference. So, because you asked me a question, I didn't respond to it. I'm responding back.
I don't remember what it was.
Well, you talked about the cap. How to keep the cap, an aggressive cap, from raising costs, basically household energy cost of living and those sorts of issues. And my response to that, And the initial question about looking at things in a transformational way is that let's break out of these silos and say, okay, we should be shifting all of our fleets, all of our rental car fleets, all of our truck fleets, all of our bus fleets to electric and getting rid of emissions in our urban areas and creating storage facilities there to store energy and keep the market from basically balancing out and keep insulate ourselves from market shocks and those sorts of things.
So I agree. I think storage is a potential game changer. Absolutely right.
It still
needs to come down in cost. And I want to make a distinction between being progressive and being aggressive. Right? So I think that's an important distinction there, such that, because no question, Reggie was the leader in developing a cap and trade program and starting off something years ahead of anyone else, right? So, but being aggressive then, again, we have to be careful that, again, we are not foreclosing future investment and locking in infrastructure that, forecloses advancements in storage, right?
Let me give you an example. New Jersey has 22 gas pipelines that are before FERC to be approved. The way we traditionally do it, I am told, in these institutions is the economy, the economics of it. So the brands that aren't economical, they'll drop by the wayside. I wouldn't do it that way. I would give people the room. Obviously, we need more gas pipelines, but 22 of them, everybody agrees to that, and knock it out. With storage, I'm very disappointed. I mean, I'm an Obama supporter, and I'm a Democrat. I always have been and always will be, I think. But with storage, when the Obama administration put all that money into meters, smart meters, that was a waste of money to me. They could have done some pilots with it. They put almost nothing into research for energy storage, which to me is almost a silver bullet. Obviously, you do energy efficiency first. For the peak days, you do demand response. There are some decent programs, but we need them better. But energy storage, I mean, you have storage. Right now, we're doing 4 or 6 hour batteries maybe. You could have them to cut those peak days so we won't have to use the peaking plants. And we use coal plants now for peaking. And we'll be using, in 20 years, gas plants for peaking. You can cut peakers by storage. And thank God for Tesla. I think all vehicles within 10 years should be any one new model. We'll still be driving on the old 56 Chevy, but not too much. Should be electric vehicles. Fleets should be electric fleets. Certainly starting in the cities. Now, a lot of the cities have CNG vehicles, which are much better than those diesel things for people's health, for asthma and that kind of thing for the residents. But EVs make sense. We don't have tariffs yet for electric vehicles. So you get free, in a lot of places, you have free charging stations for electric vehicles. That should only be like at night when it's cheap. It shouldn't be when there's a peak day. An EV guy should be paying the friggin' real-time pricing, which could be hundreds of dollars, if not $1,000 an hour. But we don't have that. Nobody has done that. The utility commissions have to do that, and it really has to be coordinated. You can have some pilots. So we have a lot to do, but it's definitely doable. But there has to be, everything has to be put together, which is why I'm hopeful that Red works.
Yeah,
go ahead, Steve.
Oh,
no,
we all want to talk at the same time.
So there's a lack of coordination, which is really key here. But I also wanted to give the audience a chance to comment or ask questions as well. Yes.
So when I think about the energy grid and where we are today, I think it's also important not to lose track of how we got to where we are, and that it's not like we just woke up one day and all of it, and we had fuel diversity in our mix. And I think it's going to be really critical to make sure that whatever future we have has some diversity, because I can guarantee you that whatever we choose today, if we choose one solution, we're going to choose wrong. So we have the benefit of having hydro and nuclear and coal and gas and solar and wind, and I think it's very short-sighted if we just focus too much on one solution, because I don't think we're smart enough to know what the future looks like.
Everybody agrees. I think everybody agrees with that. Just about. And reasonable people do. The problem is now, though, because most of this is market-driven, natural gas is so cheap, it's putting nuclear power plants out of business. It's putting not just coal plants out of business. And some states, like New York, are trying to figure out how we can, with this marketplace that we have, nuclear being put out of business, that's not smart because up those upstate nukes, you want them. So there's an issue that with the way we restructured our electric markets in a lot of the big areas, like Texas and New York and most of New England and Illinois and other states, that it's all, generation is all driven by what the market is, by our grid systems, how we set up the New York ISO and PJM, et cetera. That's a problem, which is why planning is necessary within the states and preferably within the federal government, but certainly within the states and with the regions. So it's quite, I mean, I would suggest, for instance, I fought against this 15 years ago, but it probably makes sense for the New England ISO, New York ISO, and PJM to merge. Now, the head of PJM wanted to do that 15 years ago. I fought him tooth and nail because the coal plants in Pennsylvania would be dominating. Yeah. Well, that's going away now. But New England doesn't have enough gas for their homes, let alone for electric generation. They don't have enough pipelines going up there. So, I mean, you really have to look at a huge regional area, not just New York by itself in the little ISO, and they do a good job. PJM is the best run grid in the world, technically speaking, and New England, but it's got to be bigger. Diversity makes sense, but the way we're doing the restructured dates is the cheapest electricity source is what we're using.
Yeah, so let me, because this issue of diversity, I understand we should be cautious about picking winners, but we also have to recognize, as Gene was just saying, that the system is not structured to take into account full cost or even full benefits. So those market failures, those structural issues are, for example, advantaging natural gas more than probably should be advantaged for a number of reasons. And the fact that we don't take into consideration the public health costs or consideration the environmental and community impacts of transmission lines. For example, the natural gas pipeline proposals. The Conservation Law Foundation came and mm-hmm. spoke with me, and they said, we are using 20th century thinking for a 21st century needs when it comes to our gas system. Mm-hmm. Because rather than building all of these pipelines, we should be looking at structuring the pipeline, connecting the existing yes. pipelines, and so that it acts like the grid, mm-hmm. so that where we need gas, it can get there at the speed right. of sound or as quickly as possible, and it would minimize the impacts.
Well, gas moves 20 miles an hour, so.
Yeah, well, no, you'd have to have... you'd have to.
Arturo, really. I want to pick up on a point that you made, and I think... about winners and losers, because I think this is such a relevant issue when you look at the conundrum that if there's a couple takeaways today, conundrum is a great way to describe this mess. It's a real mess from a policy perspective because there's so many players and acronyms and uncoordinated policies. But one of the reasons why that's occurring, I think, is there's a lot of potential winners and a lot of potential losers. So if you look at the gas issue, New York City and this region used to get almost all of its gas from the Gulf Coast. Mm-hmm. Until about 8 years ago when fracking started occurring in the Marcellus Shale, which is in Pennsylvania and West Virginia and other places, it's almost been completely displaced in a very short period of time. And so now if you could tell where your gas molecule came from, it probably came from Pennsylvania and not Louisiana mm-hmm. or Texas. So that's a huge shift in terms of winners and losers. And another shift... And another example of contradictory policies is, on the one hand, our governor in New York State wants to close Indian Point, and it's an important conversation to have. It's obviously an outdated facility. It's close to an urban center, but it's also the largest source of carbon-free energy we have in our region. And at the same time, the governor put forward a clean energy standard that seeks to, and if you read the footnotes, really seeks to subsidize upstate nuclear plants to keep them online. And the reason for that is really that those plants are important to jobs and the economy in those areas, and that's an important trade-off. So there's another example of winners and losers. So I think, I want to foreground that issue and get thoughts on that, because I think it's going to be, since some of these battles are so entrenched, you can have a great slogan, but it's hard to... Someone will have to win and lose in some of these issues. And I think Judith's point was right on, though. Like, the economy shouldn't have to lose. people who are just scraping by shouldn't have to lose. And I think the role of Regional Plan Association is to try to balance all these issues. I mean, advocates tend to focus on one issue. The industry is going to focus on another sets of issues. Utilities will focus on something else. RPA kind of has to take the big picture, and I think that's partly why you're seeing the investment of time and looking at this issue so closely now.
Do we have any other questions? Over here.
My name is Tom Schuster. I'm with the Sierra Club. I heard one of the panelists talk about the need for, I believe, long-term contracts for renewable energy development, or maybe any kind of energy development. But I would support the idea of, you know, as part of the regional plan, setting a goal for local governments or any large purchasers within the region to try to ramp up clean energy purchases over time, and just want to kind of throw that out for the any comment from the panel. And then the flip side of that, you know, because we've been talking about justice issues related to this, and it was alluded to that you know it's not just the cost, right? So you might purchase these long-term contracts for clean energy. In the short term, at least, that may drive up energy costs for folks, and that may be not evenly distributed and may be regressive. But at the same time, you've got, you know, still existing in New Jersey, where I'm most familiar with, where I do some of my work, you've got two large plants that still run on coal, decreasingly every year, less coal every year, but they're still there. They're still in environmental justice communities, and they have yep. health impacts. And so it's not just what you pay on your utility bill. It's also what you may be paying on your doctor bill as well. So I think those two things go hand in hand, and to look at the justice issue outside of the externalities of pollution impacts is not seeing the whole picture. So I know that's two different things, but hopefully kind of related through that lens.
In response?
Yes. Luckily, I brought with me our comments on the clean energy. So on the PPAs, I absolutely agree. Let's establish a schedule, right? So let's establish a schedule of interim annual targets, right? So I think that's important so that we tell developers where they need to be and how they need, you know, and how long we want them to take to get there. And the other thing is, with contracts, again, we need to make sure that however they are procured, that they don't undermine the wholesale market, right? That's the other important aspect, so that we keep wholesale market costs in check, right? So I think we can absolutely do things like that, and it will, I truly believe, in the long run, get us the reductions that we're all looking for.
In New Jersey, I mean, we did a whole thing. I was president for 8 years when we made all kinds of changes. What's interesting is we've been able to do an auction. We started in 02, an auction for the electric companies, and this first one in the country is very effective, and so it's low-cost energy. Because they have to, I won't go into the whole thing, but they have to bid in. This is how much they need, and then you have the companies all bidding in, like 20 of them bidding in, and then whatever the lowest price is what gets there. But commercial and industrial, as well as commercial and industrial, have to get their own, or they place something into the state because they're not shopping, right? The goal was to get them to shop. What they're shopping for is not long-term contracts. They're shopping for, like, what they had with their utility company. And so it's a really tough thing. Long-term contracts for a renewable energy, if you have wind, or in New Jersey, there's no wind, there will be offshore, but there is none now. But for solar, you can get long-term contracts. I think in Jersey, we probably have like 12 different options. What I just did, I literally just did in my two houses this last week was, I'm not technical, my husband is not technical, we're busy, we want solar, you do everything for 20 years. That's the type of contract I can deal with. My electricity bill gets lowered. They get the SREX. They take care of it. I don't care. Other people I know, usually retired engineers, they will actually want the SREX themselves and bid into them, or economists bid into the market and all that kind of stuff. So you need options based on what the customer wants. A lot of customers commercial and industrial don't want long-term contracts unless they're really a big business, which they know, and they're using a lot of electricity, then they want that.
You know, I hope to be one of those retired engineers one day. but I think those, you know, for, you know, large-scale renewables, the longer-term contracts are necessary at this point. So I believe that's the case.
So to the second part of your question statement, and building on Steve's notion of winners and losers, for coal communities where there are coal-fired power plants that are closing across the United States, those communities are both winners and losers simultaneously. The Huntley Power Plant just closed. That's the power plant in Tonawanda, New York, outside of Buffalo. 50 people lost their jobs. The last 50 people that were amounted to a skeleton crew in that plant. So, you know, they've lost their jobs. The tax base for the schools of Tonawanda just lost $2.6 million a year, which is going to have a significant ripple effects in that community. So we really need to understand that these regulations and these energy transformations, the availability of natural gas through fracking and what that's done economically, is ushering in a transformational moment in our energy system across the United States. And it's happening in a very compressed time frame. So when these sorts of things happen in a compressed time frame previously in our culture in the United States, we have stepped up and done something about it. For example, at the end of the Cold War, when the defense budget contracted, the Defense Department had a very robust effort to help the communities where those plants, the military-industrial complex plants there, had to close. We need to have that same just transition approach for coal mining communities and for communities that host coal-fired power plants. And both government and the philanthropic sector have to step up to the plate. At the moment, we don't really even have a set regulatory framework for how a coal-fired power plant is going to close, right, how it's the brownfields issues associated with its closing are going to be dealt with, and the legacy environmental public health issues that might exist are going to be dealt with. So these are things that, given what's happening right now in our energy sector, we should be thinking more carefully about.
Yeah, I'm really hopeful, prayful, that the new administration in Washington gets it all, not just this and that. DOE has some great people. The secretary is a wonderful guy. He's an MIT guy, and he's absolutely brilliant. But the local impacts on how to do this, because with all honesty, some people wanted me to go into DOE when Clinton got elected. And I said, there's no way in hell I want to go to DOE because it's basically a nuclear department. It handles nuclear. I'm not going to be dealing with Yucca Mountain and all that kind of stuff. Let me do EPA in New York. DOE needs to change its mission so that it isn't just, I mean, obviously nuclear safety and what they do is critical because of the stuff it is, but they need to broaden their mission, and they've been doing a little bit over Obama and working somewhat with EPA on this stuff, but they got to get a grasp on this stuff, and there's some very smart people at DOE, and the top guys are brilliant, but the laws haven't been written for this situation. And the scary thing is, in my opinion, Congress, at least the House, I think the Senate might get better a lot, but the House is going to be a real problem. And so the next administration will have to do probably what Obama has done, and sometimes win in court and sometimes lose in court.
Steve once again said something about nuclear power being, you know, the only major or the major non-carbon energy source. But he also, in his presentation, talked about offshore wind.
Yes.
Offshore wind, this is an example, without the right incentive structure and without the right regulatory changes that go down from the federal down to the state, because there's all sorts of permitting barriers and problems on the horizon, pun fully intended, for offshore wind, that we should start dealing with right now.
Yes.
Because it really is the only utility-scale renewable energy other than New York State. The other New England states and New Jersey and Maryland, they don't have the ability really to do onshore wind. So offshore wind is the choice for them. And the happenstance of history, the time that offshore wind produces the most power is also the time that we need the most power in our population centers across the eastern seaboard. Give or take, but anyway, so the one of the things that bugs me about the economics that I've seen for offshore wind is that for onshore wind, for many of these utility scale onshore power plants, and I'd like to hear what you say about this, the transmission costs are really usually not, there's some amount of connection. But the transmission costs are not part of the financing equation for those onshore plants, whereas for offshore wind, the transmission costs are part of it. So there's not an apples to oranges comparison going on a bit when it comes to the costs of offshore wind versus onshore. And
I want to talk about offshore wind. Hurry up.
Yeah. It's my baby.
I just remember that when I worked for the Clinton administration at EPA, I met Jean. Just remember, I worked for Romy Diaz at the time.
Ah,
but like,
I
remember, gosh, she's a firecracker. anyway, so the other aspect that's disadvantaging, this gets to your question, Danita. About sort of structural issues, that right now the short-termism that affects project finance and other parts of how we make decisions in the market, you know, it's like it doesn't take into consideration vagaries in the availability of fossil fuels with those things sufficiently. So they look at a 15-year time horizon versus when you get out in a 30-year time horizon for offshore wind. The numbers are very comparable to each other in terms of what makes the most sense to do economically.
Offshore wind, if my governor cores on that being reelected, Fisherman Energy would add offshore wind off of Atlantic City, 5 to 8 turbines, 3 years ago, because it was in the state waters, 3-mile limit. However, in 2002, I had a wind study done for New Jersey. I started in January 2002 as the president of the board. And it came back at the end of 2002 saying, we didn't have any on land. We were going to put it in every farm in New Jersey, and they make $4,000 a turbine back then. So then in 2002, the end of 2002, I did an offshore wind study done, which said we had a lot of potential offshore. And we put up, if you've been to Atlantic City, been to Atlantic City? Boy, you guys are boring. the Atlantic County
really?
Utility Authority on the island of Atlantic City has 5 wind turbines there. That were put in 2005, we gave them the seed money for that, by the Atlantic County Utility Authority. It is the number one tourist attraction in Atlantic City now. But the Eastern Seaboard...
Trump Towers?
Really?
No. He went bankrupt there. The Eastern Seaboard is especially from New York down to Virginia, because we have the outer continental shelf. Mm-hmm. They don't have that in the Pacific Ocean. Is the perfect place for offshore wind. And what there's a company that's been working on the backbone transmission line that I think Google has a piece of now that would literally run from Virginia up to northern Jersey and New York City. I had proposed, 8-10 years ago, it'd be a part of the PJM grid system so that costs can get... And you don't have... Right now, everything that's being developed with the Bureau of Energy Management at DOE, each project will have its own line coming in. That's a stupid thing. You have one backbone transmission line. All the different developers could hook in, and you have a couple places that it comes on shore and hooks into the grid system. Off of Atlantic City in Brigantine, where I have my beach house, is literally the windiest place on the eastern seaboard. And it's almost close to peak, but what's really good about it is because when you get out 20 miles out, it's windier than up close. And our studies showed that, and DOE's studies showed that. So if you put something 18 to 20 miles out, literally on the horizon, it is that big. And on a cloudy day or a foggy day, you can't see it at all. In 06, the summer of 06, we did a legitimate survey with a legitimate survey company that went on the beaches and the boardwalks in the 4 counties of New Jersey.
As opposed to those fly-by-night companies.
Yeah, we're doing it ourselves. Who actually surveyed visitors and residents about offshore wind, and they showed them pictures of what it looked like at 3 miles, at 10 miles, you know. And everybody, even for a close-up, at 3 miles, where it's like about this big, so a majority supported it, both residents and visitors. So offshore wind is doable. What hurt it was, first of all, Corzine didn't get reelected, but also secondly, that the fracking, so the economics of it, the way it's being structured by the Bureau of Energy Management, which I think they've structured it completely wrong, they structured it like leasing for offshore oil drilling. That's how they structured the parcels, which I argued about in writing back then, but it didn't work because there's a bunch of bureaucrats from that bureau who do the oil and gas leasing. They're the ones who are in charge of this.
You've got the inside information, but how does the average consumer really understand this information so that they can begin to make choices around shared solar?
Yeah, I think with community solar is definitely, and other things.
Who's educating?
Offshore wind is a political decision, and then the technical people, and they have to get their act together, and hopefully the next administration in Washington will do that. Or, in a regional basis, the governors can do that. Yeah. They almost did that about 7 years ago. Solar, community solar is being done some places. It will be done in New Jersey when we get a new governor.
Community solar up in Massachusetts.
What is, can you explain what community solar actually means?
Different things to different people.
It means so many different things. So what does it actually mean to you?
Up at one of our facilities, actually on Cape Cod in Sandwich, Mass. So we're siting an integrated development where we have a fast start gas peaking unit coupled with a community solar facility. So it's about a megawatt and a half. And what community solar allows folks to do is access renewable energy where they may not be able to do it, right? Maybe you live in a house that your roof isn't conducive to rooftop solar, right? So, you know, subscribing to a solar project that's, you know, not on your property, that's managed by someone else, and it gives you access to renewables that you wouldn't otherwise have, right? So what makes this kind of, this pairing of fast start gas plus a community solar project, you know, it's very interesting because it has shades of retail electricity. It has shades of distributed electricity, larger scale power generation, right? And then the flexibility to integrate renewables into the grid, right? So, I mean, to me, that when we talk about progressive thinking as opposed to aggressive policies,
but I changed the word right after I said that.
Okay.
By the way.
Okay. Just in case you were thinking about flipping back. I don't
know, so, how would we, so just thinking back to that postcard from Astoria, and NRG has a piece of...
That wasn't our Astoria,
no,
necessarily.
I wasn't going to put yours up.
Okay.
But on that issue, so just forgetting about that specific plan, but how could we have, can you see a vision where in this region there's a big footprint for power production, and a lot of it's not efficient, and you have these emerging models where you have some gas, really efficient, really flexible fluid with renewables, with storage, with sort of distributed planning. I mean, and thinking about how valuable those sites are. We have a housing crisis. There's environmental justice impacts. So can you see a scenario, or can others see a scenario where we can actually shrink and modernize the footprint of power, have more distributed resources, reduce carbon emissions, or is that a total fantasy?
I think it has to. I'm on a National Academy of Science panel that just started on resiliency for the distribution and transmission system. A brilliant man who's chairing it from Carnegie Mellon has cyber attacks, drought, water shortages because of climate change, earthquakes, hurricanes, ice storms, physical attacks, which do happen, the cyber attacks too. Regional storms, climate change, solar mass, it could happen. It's very scary. We want to talk about that. Tsunamis and other weather events. I believe, and I'll be arguing this to all those brilliant people on that panel, they're all technical, I am not, that a lot of customers in this region since Sandy are getting their own backup generation. We're getting their own batteries. Yeah. My Lawrence, acupuncturist, after he was out of business for 6 days for Sandy, has PSE&G put a gas line in, so when his electricity goes off, he has gas generation himself. A lot of people are doing that. The Defense Department, because of climate and tourism, are in fact doing a lot of microgrids at their facilities, smartly so, and they're really the leaders of microgrid. So we need the big grid system, and we need to figure out, Rev is working on that, how to pay for that. because you have to change how people pay for their energy use. It's a very difficult thing. We've known about that for 15 years, and we haven't done anything about it. But it's a big picture thing that you really have to deal with and have to really get into the weeds.
So one of my colleagues, Michael Mann, Michael, is working on a community microgrid in Long Beach, Long Island as a result. Yes. I mean, that was a community that was devastated by Sandy, yeah. right? So a community microgrid such that you couple, you know, a variety of resources to harden a community that, you know, otherwise was devastated. So, I mean, you can do this on a small scale. You can do it. We could do it on a large scale. For example, if we can get to the point where we can put new generation at a story, I think we'd be interested in a gen and a storage solution as well, right? So make the most of that footprint, right, in terms of efficiency, resiliency, right, and benefits to the community. I mean, to me, every development should be looking towards that. How do we do this sustainably, right, that makes the most sense for the community, that allows us to reach the carbon goals that I think we came to talk about in the carbon conundrum today, right? So I think right. we can absolutely do this.
And that's fundamentally what's driving the entire REV process, changing the utility model so that the utilities are incentivized to actually invest in right. that, and invest in those approaches, provide money. That's, you know, what's happening with Brooklyn Queens, a demand management area.
And we have so many communities that really do want microgrids,
yes.
that really want to get involved in shared solar, and there's pushback from the utility companies.
Well, that's because for 100-plus years, they made their money off of how much they sell. Supply and demand, I get my money by selling. Trying to change that model, because you still need them, at least for quite a while, as backup. So some states, Colorado, Arizona, they're now charging solar customers so much money a year for the backup, because they have net metering, and they're not paying for anything. They're getting the same amount of money that they put in for what they take it out. And there's a whole thing on net metering. I think the thing I'm doing in Princeton is going to be a net metering. There's a lot of stuff that's going on, but the utilities don't want to change because they make money building things, putting into rate base, which is how they get a return for their shareholders. That's the priority for any manager at a utility, is to earn for their shareholders. And so you have to figure out how they can make money, or at least not lose it.
Which gets back to the issue of winners and losers.
Yeah, I mean, in New Jersey, we ordered them to do stuff where they didn't make money.
I want to put out one more question. Maybe we can get maybe a show of hands in the audience. I don't know if we have time for... Yeah, we'll have a couple other questions. But question I want to ask... You guys can raise your hands, too, so we can let have some more questions from them. But just a thought exercise. If the region could... If our region's contribution to reducing carbon in the atmosphere... if we could reduce the most carbon at the least cost by just making sure that rainforests in Brazil weren't decimated, or trees were planted, or fisheries protected, or whatever the scenario is, like real verifiable carbon reductions, should we be thinking about that? Because on the one hand, it's great to have all these local programs for all the reasons, you know, we can talk about them, we might create jobs, we'll probably have local pollution reduction benefits, but if the big picture is this carbon conundrum and it's a global problem with really severe local impacts, if we can do it more quickly in another way, and this doesn't have to be, you know, either or, but should we be focused more on using some of the financial capital and resources of this region to preventing and mitigating carbon in other places? Maybe just, that was a long question, just a show of hands. Because that's something we're actually grappling with it with this plan, because we know the costs are high and there might be much less expensive ways elsewhere. Who's for, like, sending money elsewhere? Who wants to keep it all here and put solar
keep it all
on
here?
Roofs?
Well,
all right.
The country
that wasn't
should
very
do
scientific.
It.
The problem with sending the money elsewhere is that the reductions don't happen here.
Right. But why is that important, though? So for carbon, why is that important?
Well, when you're trading carbon, you're also trading other co-pollutants.
Yeah.
True.
You know, particulate matter, all kinds of stuff. And that's a co-benefit, that the cost of benefit that EPA did in reducing carbon, you also have a reduction in these other things. I could see the US of A doing it, not just this region. Our electricity is the most expensive, other than Hawaii and Puerto Rico, most expensive in the country. And our people are poor and working and hand to mouth. That's the problem with us. Now, if the whole country does it, I'm for that. But right. not this region, because our people can't afford it.
Yeah, and I think, Steve, you're talking about overseas. Right.
Well, yeah, overseas or more broadly. But yeah, I mean, overseas where they're, you know, because yeah, what we're not talking about is agricultural impacts, deforestation, you know, permafrost, release of methane. Like, there's a lot of other major causes.
There are a lot of major other
climate
major
change
causes.
And,
but I think that, you know, the world's experiment with the Clean Development Mechanism, which was the mechanism that was really intended to help to facilitate what Steve is talking about, it kind of fell over under its own weight because it was highly top-down, and in order to have the credits to be traded, it had about 5,000 projects to be traded at the height of that market, it was too intrusive. The auditing required to make sure that those credits, that the markets really accepted that those credits actually were valuable and were doing what they purported to do, was perceived as not scalable, at least at that point. Mm-hmm. I think it probably would be easier to institute that kind of system if you had a global carbon price, if you had even a patchwork of carbon taxation and indirect carbon pricing through trading systems. If you had that in place, that probably could work, because then there's ways to pay for that auditing, for that verification of the greenhouse gas reductions as part of the system. But doing it until that's in place, I don't think is feasible.
Okay. So we have a question here.
Steve, this is getting at your slide regarding loads and demands, and partially at your turn regarding community resiliency. So I think from most people I know in the building science world, they would say the best way to create a clean kilowatt is still to conserve.
Yes.
And mm-hmm. so when we go about, I think, radically, for example, insulating our buildings, right, just as one little mind-bendy thing, you have this big thermal lag in heating and cooling, which offsets peak demand a lot, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. right? And, you know, so, and that's very good for resiliency in communities, too, right?
Because energy cost of living, yeah.
Exactly, you know, radically reducing energy costs for communities. So it's just one of these things where, you know, I know RPA is thinking these amazing, great things. It just is the conservation side of it, I think, is a piece that maybe needs to be addressed a little bit.
I think that's right. I mean, we're focusing on the power sector here, but we have a sort of transportation-oriented energy issue and buildings, too. But I think you're totally right about that.
I mean, energy efficiency building codes aren't as strict as they are in this region. They should be much stricter. I mean, I remember a hotel 15 years ago in Europe, to get my electricity on the room, you got to put the room key in there. I've only gone to one hotel in this country that has that. There are so many things that we don't do. Appliance standards, EPA, DOE do them jointly. Luckily, this administration finally upped them, because under George W. for 8 years, they didn't do anything. They should be much more strict than they are. It's not that we don't have the technology to make everything. Refrigerators are much more efficient than they were 10 years ago now. You should buy one if you got an old one. But they could be. We have the technology to make much more efficient and smart use it, so that the utility can actually demand a peak time, can turn your air conditioning off. We've been doing that for 20 years in New Jersey when there's a high peak. Well, you could do that with other appliances if they have a smart chip in them. That technology is available today. We need stronger appliance standards set by EPA and DOE, and we need stronger building codes set by the states and municipalities. That's the first thing.
Yeah, well, stronger building codes that can be enforced.
Yes.
Who has a question? Maybe just raise your hands if you have. All right, we have a lot of questions. We need to give like 20-second answers to your questions, because we want to get your.
This is. I hope you give me a few good things in 20 seconds. I'm on the town level. We've just completed a comprehensive plan. We've implemented green building codes, and we're moving the fleet to hybrid and electric. But I'd love to get a couple of other really good ideas that a town, not the federal government or the state, but a town can implement as we make up the region, and if enough towns do things, it will have a regional impact.
Well, there's a new, as part of the REV process, there's a new community choice aggregation rule that's been passed, so that a town can sort of get together and say, well, we want we want to all our energy to come from offshore wind. You could even do that. And by aggregating the power of all of those businesses, small businesses, nonprofits, institutions, individual homeowners within that community, you have power. It gives you power within the market. So, and this is once again one of these new things that is going to take time for the impacts to be realized, and why NYSERDA's efforts to promote community energy planning is so important, because really your community should have the opportunity to understand the ramifications of what all these changes are and make the choices that reflect your values and your priorities.
Are enough resources going to those kinds of programs?
What do you mean by the
programs? To let communities and towns and municipalities understand these issues.
Yeah, see, that's why the New York Community Trust, it's not happened yet, so this is embargo, Chatham House rules. There's a recommendation going to my board at the beginning of June to go to a group of organizations called the Revitalize Coalition, a play on words on REV, and that coalition is focusing on community energy planning in the context of everything that's going on, and NYSERDA is sort of part of the mix, and they're going to take their experiences from those three communities, pilot communities doing this, to inform this RFP that I mentioned that they're going to release later this year. And then after that RFP, they're going to see, well, what's necessary? What kind of rules do we need? What kind of technical assistance do we need in order to allow communities to do that kind of planning?
New Jersey has something called Sustainable Jersey that we set up with our seed money about, I don't know, 10, 12 years ago. Local municipal, used to be the environmental commissions, are now these green committees, and they're doing all kinds of projects all over the state. Most towns are in it now. It's voluntary. They have awards and all kinds of stuff. Something like that makes sense, and so go onto Sustainable Jersey's website, see what they're doing. The second thing is, I did smart growth, walkable communities, sustainable communities, bike paths, like they're doing in the city, but building codes that you can allow. You don't zone the way we've been zoning suburbia forever. You zone so the businesses are on the first floor, and you have above it, like you know in a city, you have the people live above it, and they can walk to transportation, and they can take their bikes, and they're not driving their cars. That's why a lot of people are moving back into the urban areas, is because of their own cars.
Next question over in the back. Yep.
Hi. As you all know, the RPA region spans three independent system operating regions, three regional transmission organizations. And one of those, PJM itself, goes very far west out to Chicago. And so I wonder, from a governance perspective, is there a governance problem with our electricity or, in particular, our energy planning? And do we need to be thinking about a new form for the Eastern Seaboard or for the New York area, a new form of electricity governance? And I'm looking at Commissioner Fox.
No, we've been talking about that. As I said before, I kind of fought off PJM expanding into, actually it was Audrey Zimmerman's husband, expanding PJM to New York and New England. I fought him off because of the coal plants in Pennsylvania that I don't want us to use more coal. But now with the Clean Power Plan, if it survives the court, I think it's a good possibility that we should be doing something like that, because that's the only reason that we stopped it before. It's very clear that PJM's governance structure, and they all know this, I've told them, the board members, is, I think, is broken, that it's dominated by their members, which are not basically citizens, they're transmission companies, they're utilities, they're merchant plants, and they're supposed to be in the public interest, they're all nonprofits. But I think the governance structure is not, New England is better, NYSERDA is better, than PJM's governance structure. But I think it makes sense now that coal is going by the wayside that we probably do that.
Yeah, we're definitely going to be looking at governance issues. But, it's easy to say just consolidate all three of those areas. We could just start with, setting the same rules in place. So, there's a tariff on selling energy from one region to the other. It costs you $5 more per whatever.
They've been working on it for the last 10 years.
We're definitely going to be looking at those issues. But who else? Questions out there?
Any last questions before we wind up? Okay. Well, I want to thank all of our dynamic, talkative panelists today. I think we've had a great conversation, and I hope that you all have enjoyed it and gotten something out of it as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you.